1-800-FANDANGO.
Do you want to look in and around New York? You can also enter a theater express code followed by pound. Or for restaurants and other services, you can say, call 411.
I forgot. What was the original question? Am I supposed to be looking around New York?
I'm sorry, I still didn't get that. If you want to look in New York, New York, say yes or press 1. Otherwise, say no or press 2 to pick another location.
Yeah, I'll look in New York. That sounds good to me. By the way, we're here with John Seabrook.
I'm having trouble understanding. To look in New York, New York, press 1.
Yeah, New York. I'll look in New York. Do you get that? We are here with John Seabrook of The New Yorker, who just wrote about voice recognition software. How you doing there, Fandango?
Please try your call again later. Thanks for calling 1-800-FANDANGO. Goodbye.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Fandango. Well, John, I guess I just had, a typical experience when using this voice recognition software? What didn't she get about me?
She doesn't get your current vibe. She wants you to be like a straight-laced guy.
I guess.
You're a loose-goosey guy.
I'm on a pretty clean phone line. If I was on a bad cell phone and was just saying yes or no, would they be able to get that?
Doubt it.
Really? So what are the big weaknesses of voice recognition software in general?
Well, you know, the big weakness is that people say things in all kinds of different ways. They say yes in any of 20 or 30 different ways, you know, or they say yes, ma'am, or yes, sir, if they're from the South. And the system is, I mean, they try to anticipate all different ways people are going to say something, but language always evolves, always changes. People kind of want to say things in new, fun ways, and computers just can't really keep up.
So there, it's like an arms race between the slang for yes and what computers understand.
Yeah, I mean, another example of that is the whole Valley Girl way of raising your voice at the end of a sentence.
You know, uptalk?
Yeah, when you're actually making a declarative sentence. That's something the computers can't really get at all because they think you're asking them a question. You know?
Well, that would be good. That would be useful in real life. Maybe we could drum that out of people. But so will computers understand the slang of 2 months ago? I mean, is it constantly inputted, or once the voice recognition software is in place, can't you update it?
You can update it, but it's not something that's real simple to do. And I mean, basically, this is a cost. It's all a cost. From the corporate point of view, they don't want to spend money on this because the whole reason for doing it is to save money. Talking to a real person costs a lot more than talking to a machine. So at a certain point, if you're updating it, you know, every few days, it's probably going to cost a lot more than they really want to spend.
And what kind of – you quoted, a $5 per call cost in your article. That seemed high to me. It really cost them $5 to deal with a customer?
That's on the low side of the numbers that I saw. It was between 5 and 15 are the numbers that are given. Although when you think about how much they're paying the people out in Bangalore, you know, in the call centers, which is like a couple dollars an hour, if that, I don't really know what costs that much money, but that's what they say.
Another number in your article is 43 billion. That's the number of minutes North Americans lost last year to, you know, wasting their time with trying to deal with customer service on the phone. I did the math. 43 billion minutes, that's 80,000 combined years. That's more than 80,000 years spent on the phone last year. That was mind-boggling to me. How about to you?
Yeah, I know. It's a nightmare. When you think about just how much frustration you can get from 5 minutes, you know, or even what you just had, you know, 1 minute, and
right.
You know, and then you'd make it 43 billion minutes. That's like a lot. If you could bottle that frustration, you could like move mountains with it probably.
Have you found that people are more frustrated because they're being asked to use voice recognition software and the software is just not up to the task?
Well, I don't know. I mean, there are situations where it works. The thing about it is if you have a very specific task for which there are only a few possible ways of saying it, it works pretty well.
But then again, if you do that, you could just press 1 or 2. If there's simple tasks with binary choices, I always opt for the keypad.
Yeah, I mean, if you have a keypad in front of you, you might want to do that. But I don't know, maybe you're sort of kicked back in your chair or, you know, whatever. You don't feel like taking the phone away from your ear and pressing the 1. What you were working with there was a kind of what they call natural language understanding program. They don't tell you say yes or say no. You're supposed to be able to speak as you would speak. And that's usually where things go wrong.
Yeah. And Amtrak's Judy.
Julie.
Julie?
Julie is her name. she's the Amtrak voice. She sounds kind of like that Fandango voice. I mean, there are a few voice talents that you hear quite a lot. It's kind of a lucrative business, you know, for people who have the right voice to be the voice of whatever.
Always women? Do any companies want to go with an authoritative man?
Google has a guy. He's not that authoritative. You know, Google now has a 411 number, so you can. It's 800-GOOG-411, and that has a guy. But he's kind of like a. He's not really a macho guy. He's more of a kind of a computer sort of nerdy type guy.
Oh, okay. I was going to think maybe the drinking buddy, but he's like
he's not a drinking buddy.
So it was like if Google came to life, he'd be this guy.
Like if you call Bud, maybe yeah. You can get like a drinking buddy.
So what were the most surprising things that you found out that were hurdles for computers to recognize human voices?
Well, one of the interesting things about the whole world of voice recognition is that it's all probability-based. I mean, there's no actual understanding of what you're saying. It's all based on the probability of that what you said might be this or might be this. And that was a decision made many years ago by the researchers because they realized that they couldn't figure out the rules of language, you know, how we actually understand and use language. So they made this one choice. And you know, now we're seeing some of the fruits of that. Like translation, for example, works pretty well with speech recognition. And I saw these translators that were actually kind of amazing. They translated from English into Arabic and Arabic back into English that they're now using at checkpoints in Iraq. Because a lot of times you don't have a translator and it's dangerous to be a translator. And so if you have something that you can at least introduce a little understanding into the situation, you know, I think that can help diffuse tensions. But there are a lot of, you know, the emotional component of speech, which it turns out is a lot more important to speech than we thought. We didn't know that until we started making speech recognizers that couldn't recognize emotion. And it turns out a lot of what goes on in our voice is actually a kind of an emotional thing that isn't just logical. It isn't just about the words, but it's about the way we say them and the emphasis we give them. And all of that is just completely dark in terms of what computers can understand.
Are these companies trying to get into the realm of if they have an angry customer on the line, deal with them a different way than some guy who's just giving your yes, no answers?
Yeah, I mean, because from a company's point of view, if somebody's angry, and particularly if it's like a sale is at stake, they want to transfer that person to an agent. But even there, the software is very primitive. I mean, it's basically just like if the guy is shouting obscenities, then he's, you know, probably angry. You know, but it's not like they can pick up, you know, the sort of nuanced anger. Or in a piece, I talk about how there's cold anger where people speak very slowly, and that could be perceived not as anger at all.
I want to see the Incredible Hulk Fandango.
Right. And also the other problem there is that if you make a mistake and you think someone's angry and in fact they're not, or you think they're sad and you start sort of, then the voice turns very sort of sympathetic in an inappropriate context.
Right.
That would just be, you know, a nightmare. But another interesting thing is that speech recognizers are all trained with speech. And up until recently, they've only used acted speech, actors speaking lines. And so by collecting all these angry voices and real angry voices and feeding those into the recognizers, there's actually a chance they can improve and you know, respond to the way people really speak.
Because you're right, even an actor approximating anger doesn't get to real anger that a very finely calibrated machine perhaps could sense. Acted anger is different from real anger. If you have a great machine, they could sense that.
Yeah, the vocal cords apparently vibrate in a different way when you're truly enraged, and that's damaging or can be damaging to your voice. So actors tend to not hit that point. Also, actors tend to emote all at once. They turn on anger all at once, whereas in fact, anger usually builds
right
over several utterances.
When you wrote that in the article, my mind flashed to, this is what I want to use the machine to find out if Bill O'Reilly is just acting angry or if he really is driven over the edge. So you mentioned the translation. I did come away thinking that as messed up as voice recognition software and customer services, there seems to be some pretty bright spots, not only in terms of translation, but this Dutch train station kind of has this sound recognition software that helps cut down on vandalism. Tell me about that.
Yeah, well, you know, you have cameras installed in a lot of public places, but cameras can only pick up like a visual sort of angry action. And usually by the time people are actually hitting someone, something that a camera can see, it's too late.
Yeah.
Whereas if they can pick up the voice, they can sense that a violent confrontation might be occurring in about 40 seconds or a minute. And they can then try to respond or at least train the cameras on that. And, you know, actually, that worked really well, as I said in the article, because it doesn't pretend to be any more intelligent than it is. It just does one thing. But what it does, it works pretty well.
The article is called Hello, Hal. And throughout it, you talk about how Taken You Were by 2001, the Stanley Kubrick film, and when the computer Hal gets smart and speaks soothingly, "I'm sorry, Dave." But did the impetus for this article come from fond memories of the 2001 film, or did it come from frustration at having to deal with an online call center?
Well, for me, it came from the Hal, because it's 40 years since the movie came out, and I saw it when I was 9, and it really did. Like, just talking to a computer is, as I said in the article, you could marry language and tool making. You would achieve the two greatest human technologies kind of brought together, and that would be an extraordinary. I mean, you think about all the things that could be done with your voice. You'd never have to use a keyboard. I mean, that would be amazing, but it's really still Hollywood stuff, you know? And in a way, Hollywood is kind of misled us, as it often does, I guess, into expecting more than the technology can actually offer.
Of all the voice recognition experts, computer experts that you spoke with, did anyone give you a really good tip that you could share with our audience in terms of how to deal with the voice recognition guy on the other end of the line?
Well, definitely don't say yes, ma'am, and yes, sir. Don't be polite. You know, don't treat them like they're humans, because if you do, they're not going to understand, you know, where you're coming from.
And have you changed your behavior when given the option between punching one or saying one? Do you still punch one on your keypad?
No, I say it. I mean, my one seems to be pretty well understood, you know? And I just, it's still kind of a kick when it works.
Yeah.
You know? So.
To me, the craziest thing is when they say, punch in or say your 18-digit account number. Right. I'm gonna give you 18 chances to mishear me. I'll just be punching it in. Thank you.
Well, the other one there is that somebody can then be sort of standing behind you and listening to your 8-digit account number, whereas you're punching it in and they might not see you doing it. So.
It's both fascinating article and practical tips from John Seabrook of The New Yorker. He wrote, "Hello, how will we ever get a computer we could really talk to?" in the newest edition of The New Yorker. Thanks a lot, John.
Thanks. Good to be here.
And that is it for this hour of the BPP. We are always online at npr.org/Bryant Park. Let's chill out to these sounds for a second. Then I'll come back and tell you a little bit about the people who helped us with the show. The Bryant Park Project is directed by Jacob Ganz and edited by Trish McKinney. I'm sorry, did you try to say Ish Matrini? No, Trish McKinney. Our technical director is Manoli Weatherall. I'm sorry, did you say Amoli Utherall? No, ugh, stop it, voice recognition person. Our staff includes Dan Pashman, Ian Chillog, Wynn Rosenfeld, Angela Ellis, Lauren Sporer, Caitlin Kenny, Paul Hechinger, maybe Hechinger? Gotta ask Paul about that later. Zaina Barakat. And Laura Silver. Laura Conaway edits our website and blog. Our newscaster is Mark Garrison, unless sometimes when it's Corva Coleman, and you never know by how I introduce that segment. Our senior producer is Matt Martinez. Sharon Hoffman is our executive producer. I'm Mike Pesca. We're online all the time at npr.org/Bryant Park. Are you trying to say Ryan Dark? No, Bryant, I hate you. This is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News.